Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired in the Premier Networks on Saturday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, 2018. This is episode 1485. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by 23andMe. Now through Mother's Day, get 20% off each 23andMe DNA kit, plus free gift wrap. Just for mom. Go to 23andMe.com/twit today. And by IT Pro TV, flexible and entertaining training for your IT career. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 to get a free 7-day trial, plus 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/tech guy. Well, hey, Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. It's Cinco de Mayo, the Cinco de Mayo Tech Guy show on the air. Today we are not talking about Cincos or Mayos. We're talking about computers, the internet, technology, home theater. Scott Wilkinson's coming up, our home theater guy. We talk about digital photography. We talk about smartphones, of course, smartwatches. It's going to be a big week this week. All the big developer conferences are coming up. Apple's is next month. But this week, Google I.O., their big developers conference is this week. Microsoft's big developer conference, Build, starts Monday. This is a big week for, and I tell you what, even though you and I are not software developers, these are important if you use programs. These are important events because companies use these events to talk about their future. They're particularly aiming at developers, at programmers, but there's a message they want to give programmers. Here's where the company's going. Here's what we see as the big opportunity. Here's what we'd like you to work on. So always pay close attention to these events. Facebook's developers conference is coming up, F8. That'll be interesting just to see what Mark Zuckerberg says after he's been kind of mildly spanked. Very mildly spanked over Facebook privacy violations. Google will have probably a lot to say. Microsoft will have a lot to say about something new that both of them are working on, both of them are supporting, that I think many people, and myself included, think may be the future of software. Microsoft has started to acknowledge this. You know, it's hard for Microsoft. They've became a super successful, powerful virtual monopoly in the 90s based solely on the success of Microsoft Windows. And even to this day, 95% of all computers in the world run Microsoft Windows. That's dominant. And it's been very good, by the way, not just for Microsoft, not just for the shareholders, but it's been very good for all of us because a consistent operating system, a consistent platform makes it easier for everybody. It's easier for you and me because once you learn how to use Windows, you can, you know, sit down at almost any computer and use it. Easier for developers because they know there's a market. They know there's 1 billion Windows users, so there's people who will buy their software. They also, this is a little more inside baseball, but when you write programs on Windows or any good operating system, you don't have to write as much code. Windows handles a lot of the things you might think a program would have to handle, like how to draw a window, how to position a window, what to do with files, what to open, how to open them and delete them or change them. A lot of the stuff that programs do, programmers don't even have to write. Microsoft did. And Apple did for iOS and Mac OS, and Google did for Android. So these platforms are very important, I think, for computing for all of us. You want the consistency. You want a kind of guaranteed market. Developers, really, look what happened to Windows Phone. It's a perfect example. Because Windows Phone failed to take off, it entered a death spiral. Developers, people didn't buy it. Developers then said, well, there's no market, so they didn't develop for it. the death knell was finally sounding when banks said, we're not going to write our software. We're not going to put bank software on Windows Phone anymore. And it was, and so fewer people bought it, so fewer programs were developed, and it just was a death spiral and was over. Really, totally dominant, obviously, right now, Android and iOS. Those are the mobile platforms. There are far more mobile phones out there than there are computers. It is the de facto computer for most people, especially in the developing world, let alone in the U.S., but in the developing world. And if you're a developer, one of the things that is very attractive about these platforms is you can make money, fairly good money, selling apps in their app stores, the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store. That's good money. So these developers will be going and looking, and Google and Microsoft may have a message. Now, it's in Microsoft's interest because they don't have a mobile platform, but it's interesting that Google's behind that, and even to some degree Apple's behind it. The idea of something called progressive web apps. You're going to probably start hearing more about this, although the idea is you won't even know. You'll be using them and you won't even know. The idea is when you go to the App Store, whether it's on a mobile device or a desktop, or you go to a website, these websites, these apps are written in such a way that you download pieces of them and they can operate offline when you're not online. So I'll give you an example. Let's say your bank, I don't know if bank's a good example. Let me think of something that might be, Twitter has one actually. Twitter has a very good progressive web app, the mobile Twitter app, mobile.twitter.com. If you go there on your phone, you can actually make a icon on the screen. It'll launch. It'll run even when you're not online. It'll show the previous tweets. It won't get new ones, obviously. It can't. But it'll be fairly functional. You can send a tweet that will then be sent out when you get online. That's actually a pretty good example because it's a mobile version of the Twitter app, a progressive web app version of the Twitter app that a lot of people are using, especially in countries where bandwidth is a little less reliable, right? You want an app that'll work even if, you know, your bandwidth's coming and going. Both Microsoft and Google are 100% behind this new technology. I understand why Microsoft is, because they don't have mobile, right? But even Google's behind this. And what it gives you, which is what's really awesome for us as users, is companies can make their website or even apps they sell in the app stores, make one that will work on both. This has always been the holy grail. Developers hate it that they have to spend all this energy making an app for iOS and then make it for Android. In fact, you'll see this all the time, that apps will come out for iOS and then much later, if ever, come out for Android and vice versa. So the promise of progressive web apps is you write one app. It looks great on both platforms. It works on both platforms. We'll find out. I mean, we're going to find out this week at Google I.O. and Microsoft Build, their two big developer conferences. But it's my prediction that they're going to really urge developers to move there. And I'll tell you why this is a good thing, because it means that it's no longer about the operating system, Windows or Mac or Android or iOS. We've fought so many wars over this, right? It isn't about that anymore. It's just about going online. It's kind of like you and your browser. Do you care? When you use your browser, let's say you're using Chrome, most people do. It doesn't matter when you're using Chrome, whether you're using Google, maybe the Chrome OS or iOS or Android or Windows or Mac, it's the same experience. The only thing that varies is the screen size, but it's the same experience across the board. And I think that's good for consumers. I think that it really is. It means we'll get better applications. We'll get a broader range of applications on all platforms. We don't have to think about, and frankly, we don't have to worry about what operating system we're running or choose a operating system and get on Team Windows or Team Mac. Those teams go away because they're all basically the same. They're all on the internet. The platform that we're all running on now becomes the web. And I, for one, think that's a very good thing. I think it'll give us more consistency. Users will find it easier. It will be more secure. Microsoft's already kind of acknowledged this. They did something my colleague Mary Jo Foley at ZDNet called demoting Windows. They demote Windows, which was the app, the number one driver of income for Microsoft, is less important now. It's actually happening at Apple as well. They may not admit it, but Apple's making more money in services, which is apps in the App Store and music and iCloud, than they make on Macintosh. They're making more money on those services than they make selling hardware. Wow. Because they make a lot of money every Macintosh. There's a good profit margin in there. When companies see this, they realize that what we think of as computing is changing dramatically. We'll talk some more about this, but in the long run, what it really is the computer moving out of that thing you hold and out to the edges. Intelligence is everywhere. Computers are in everything, and they all talk to one another, and they all serve you, depending on the device. It's hard to get your head around, but it's the future of computing. Anyway, that's what we talk about, that and how to get your printer working. Give me a ring. Let's talk. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's go to the, as they say, let's go to the phones. And on the line now from Indianapolis, Indiana, it's Jim. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I am great. I guess the Indy 500 is coming up at the end of the month, huh?
Yeah, just a couple of weeks away.
Did you leave town for that?
No, that is the best month in the state of Indiana.
Oh, how fun.
Because there is so much going on. It's usually great weather for it. There's flowers blooming. It was just excitement all around the state.
I went once to the parade, and it was a blast. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
The downside is if you live in Indianapolis or central Indiana, you can't watch the race because it's blacked out.
Right. I know. I hate that. What's the deal? Everybody's going to go anyway. You don't need to. Oh, man.
Yeah.
What can I do for you today?
Well, last month, you had mentioned one of the shows, and there were some articles that had come out talking about the Department of Homeland Security coming out and putting together a database.
Oh, yeah. This really scared me. Now, it could be completely legitimate. DHS wants to keep track of all media outlets worldwide, including podcasters and bloggers, and they want to monitor them for mentions of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, it could be that they're monitoring for people who are saying, you know, hey, I've got, you know, evil intent and I'm going to do something wrong. And that would be, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But I get very nervous when the federal government starts to monitor the free press, because it's a very important, I believe free press is an important part of our democracy. And the current administration doesn't seem to like a free press very much. And I worry when I hear that.
I totally agree with you on that. And you've had quite a few people calling in recently asking about VPN. And I'm wondering, because I work in media, and I'm wondering, is that something I should be using more? Or just using in general?
Along
with that is that I've got an ASUS router at home.
Yeah.
And I know I can install or I can run an open VPN, both a client and the server. And I'm wondering, if I connect to that, does that still show it back at my home location when it goes in and out to the internet? So
yeah.
Should I be using a different service altogether?
Yeah, that doesn't really anonymize you, because you'll be entering the public internet from your home. So
right.
It's kind of like saying,
the purpose.
Yeah, Jim is here, and here's what he's doing. This is, and I have friends who are working on this. They work with dissidents around the world to help them be dissidents, to help them be opposition media without risking themselves. A VPN is potentially a useful tool, but is not technically a privacy tool. And so this is an important thing to understand, and it's not an easy thing to understand. Fortunately, Jim, we still live in a democracy and we still have a free press, but there are people all over the world who do not, and it is certainly something worth preserving here in the United States. So I think you absolutely should educate yourself. It becomes more important if you are a reporter who is getting leaks, who is gathering information from whistleblowers, and you want to preserve your sources' privacy, right? If you're a journalist, job one is protecting the anonymity of your sources.
Right.
And of course, for obvious reasons, the people the sources are whistleblowing on are desperate to figure out who those whistleblowers are so they can shut them down. So that does become a big issue in media. And I think I'm sad to say we kind of have to start using the tools that we have given to journalists in Turkey and in Russia, in China, around the world to work, do their job safely and privately, we have to start kind of adopting here in the United States.
So in that situation, would a outside VPN service be something that may be worthwhile?
It would help. I mean, one of the reasons people use VPNs now is to keep their internet service provider from knowing what they're doing. So we know that, you know, for all the talk about Facebook invading your privacy, your ISP knows even more about you. It's actually one of the reasons Facebook now encrypts your conversations with Facebook. Google does the same thing so that – because Facebook wants to keep all the things it knows about you to itself so it can sell it. So it really doesn't want your internet service provider to see all this. There's also security issues at stake. So Facebook uses HTTPS, and so when you communicate with Facebook or when you're getting your Gmail, that data is encrypted and your ISP can't see it. And in fact, it's you don't need a VPN for stuff like that. But when you're on a site that isn't HTTPS, a VPN will help you there because everything you're saying to that site is traveling through the network in plain text, including right. any open Wi-Fi network. And really, that's where people are really more interested in protecting themselves with a VPN is that. But a VPN doesn't anonymize you because at some point you are going to have enter from the virtual private network server into the outside world. You have to, or you wouldn't be able to communicate with outside sites. And at that point, well, your IP address shouldn't be your IP address anymore, although we are also learning that some VPNs leak IP addresses in a variety of ways. You're still you. If you, for instance, used a VPN to log into Amazon, it'd still be you. They'd know, oh, there's Jim using Amazon. So if you used Facebook, there's no privacy there. So you have to understand what a VPN does. It does anonymize your IP address if it's done properly. If you're using a VPN server, a third-party service that doesn't log transactions, and good ones don't, that's something you're looking for, is no logging, then you're somewhat private. But if for true privacy, you might attach to that something called Tor, the Onion router, which further anonymizes your traffic. Then that's really more of a privacy tool. And you can read more about Tor at the Tor Project, T-O-R-P-R-O-J-E-C-T, which is the Tor Project, torproject.org. And there are browsers you can use if you want to use Tor. The reason a lot of people don't use VPNs and even less Tor is because it does slow you down. Because the way Tor works is it routes you through multiple servers. So there is a slowdown involved. I use, and I've recommended in the past, and I wouldn't hesitate to recommend it to media professionals who wanted to have more private conversations. I use a piece of hardware from tinyhardwarefirewall.com that has both a VPN and Tor that you can enable as needed.
Now, and a question with the hardware side on that, because when I was looking at my Asus router to install it, and I've read all kinds of articles talking about here's how you install. It seems pretty simple to do.
It is.
But nowhere does it say how you access it if you're outside your network.
You'll use VPN software on your computer to log into your internet address.
Okay, so I'm just going to the IP address.
Your personal IP address. And okay. You'll probably, but you'll have to read the documentation, append to your IP address colon and a number, which is the
okay,
port.
Okay, so a port.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there's a VPN port. You'll probably use a port that you designate rather than the generic VPN port for additional secrecy.
Okay.
There is right. there. My friend Dan Patterson, who is now at Tech Republic, did a lot of training for media and dissidents on how to do all of this stuff. And I want to see if I can find his materials because he was teaching people in all sorts of, you know, Venezuela and China. He was teaching journalists how to protect what they're doing. And it was really great stuff. If I can find that, I'll pull a link in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's time to talk audio, video, home theater with our home theater geek, Scott Wilkinson. He's at the avsforum.com where he's editor. And I love it when you come on because I get to kind of dream about things. One of the things I've always wanted is for the house is a projector. Not that I need one for, you know, like my regular TV, but just for like a summer night. We get the weather starting to turn, going outside and projecting it on a screen outside.
Well, certainly there's outdoor projection, outdoor movie theater night. Generally speaking, I would say that projectors give you a more cinematic experience. If for no other reason, then it's like I'm going out to a movie theater where they have a projector shooting onto a screen and you're in a dark room. That is one of the dangers, or one of the limitations, I should say, of having a projector, is you really, for the most part, need a pretty dark room. You need it to be light controlled. So it either needs to be nighttime,
right,
or you need to have good shades.
But it's kind of, for me, it's a little nostalgic. It's like a drive-in theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we set it up in the backyard. I happen to have a screen left over from when I did have a projector, so I just bring the screen out there and plug in the projector. Usually I have to bring a couple of speakers for the sound because it's not very loud. But we live out in the country, so it doesn't bother the neighbors. And now we can, you know, have a drive-in. And it's fun. People bring out the blankets, and I really enjoy that.
That is a lot of fun.
But
I agree.
When you take it inside, it's another matter entirely, because I rarely have the room to do this.
Yes, it does require some room and some careful thought. Now, there is a solution to that that I want to make sure people understand, and that is what's called ultra short throw projector. So it's a projector like any regular projector, but instead of being placed, say, on the ceiling at the far end of the room from where the screen is, it's placed basically right up against the wall where the screen is. It looks like a sort of a box. You can put it on a credenza or something like that. It shoots way up at a steep angle to the screen that's right there on the wall right next to it, and it gives you a projected image, typically 100 inches or bigger.
But yeah. I don't have to be 10 feet or 15 feet away.
Absolutely not. And the other good, one other good thing about it is when you have a regular projector and somebody walks into the room, they might walk into the beam of the projector.
Yes, it's so annoying.
Cast a shadow.
Sit down. Annoying. Yeah,
down in front. Right. Yeah, exactly. No, but an ultra short throw projector that does not have that problem. It's sitting there right next to the wall. So it's like a box of some sort sitting on the wall. But then you've got this big image, 100 inches or wider, on the wall. And I recommend getting a screen for that, of course. I mean, some people would just project onto a wall, but I don't like that for several reasons. One is the wall, probably not the right color of white. It's also probably textured to some degree. So you want some kind of screen. And typically what you get for an ultra short throw projector is what's called an ambient light rejecting screen.
Uh-huh.
And basically that accepts or reflects the light from the projector in the direction you want, back out into the audience. But it reflects light from elsewhere in the room, like an overhead light or a light over on the side. It reflects it away from where the audience is. And so you still get a pretty good image. On a regular screen with a regular projector, if you have the lights on in the room, the image looks very washed out, very dull and uninteresting. So you really need an ambient light rejecting screen to do that, to use an ultra short throw projector. So if you want a big screen TV, and really what an ultra short throw projector does is it simulates the effect of a really big TV. So if you wanted a 100-inch flat panel TV, that would cost you a lot of money. Easily in the five figures, maybe even into the six figures.
Yeah.
You can get a ultra short throw projector and screen for a lot less than that. Now, you can also spend a lot of money. There are a number of examples I wanted to show you. Probably the most expensive one is the Sony VPL VZ1000ES, which goes for $50,000.
Yeah, when Scott says the most expensive one, you can stop listening. Okay. But if you've got 50 in your pocket, what is it? The EV?
It's called the VZ1000ES.
Okay. Wow.
Now they just came out with a new one that they shaved the price down to $30,000. The LSPX-A1. Now, both of these are 4K resolution with HDR and laser illumination. So they're top of the line. So no question about it.
This is what you're going to get if you go to see a movie at Shaq's house.
Yes, exactly.
This is not for the average Joe.
That's right. Yeah. Now, Hisense, this is a Chinese company, yeah, has been showing for a couple of years something they call the laser TV, which is an ultra short throw projector, laser illuminated, 4K, that shoots up onto a 100-inch screen. Now, in this case,
you know what's funny about this? The picture, it looks like it's right below the screen.
That's right. That's
it's
right.
What, it's just pointing like straight up.
Almost straight up. It's not at 90 degrees to the floor, but it's close.
See, this maybe fits into somebody's house who would have a flat panel TV on the wall and
precisely
nowhere to put a projector. Wow,
precisely.
That's amazing. And it works
that's
well.
Exactly right. Yes, it does. The Hisense laser TV comes with a 100-inch screen,
oh,
ideal
nice
for that. For $10,000, okay?
Oh.
So it's still expensive.
You got me all excited.
Well, how about this? How okay about this? Dell, okay, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Dell, the
yeah
computer company,
yeah,
makes the S718QL, which is 4K, a laser based, for $6,000. Optima's about to come out with one for $5,000.
And these are also short throw.
Yeah, these are all ultra short throw projectors. Exactly. They all do the same thing, what we've been talking about. You put a box up right up, almost up against the wall. It has to be separated out a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, you
much
probably, if
but
you
inches
have a TV, you already have like a TV hutch or something underneath it.
Exactly.
So
exactly
this would just
right
go right on that. That's
yep
kind of remarkable.
It really
now
is.
Now, how's the picture quality?
Generally speaking, it's very good. Now, I was not that impressed with the Hisense laser TV at CES, but that was very unconventional environment, right?
You've challenging.
Got CES.
Challenging.
A challenging
word
environment
yes
is the word I was looking for.
Yes.
Precisely.
Yes.
You've got these Klieg lights overhead, right? And you don't have those at home. So I bet you it's probably quite a bit better than what I saw at CES.
Yeah, yeah.
LG just introduced one at CES 2018. We don't know. They didn't say how much it was, but it's also 4K. And if it's in the few $1,000 range, that's way less than you're going to get a 100-inch flat panel for, if you could even find one.
I love the idea of a 100-inch TV in my
mm-hmm
opinion. Now you kind of got me interested.
Mm-hmm.
But can you go see these anywhere? Is there anywhere people have a showroom
right
for this kind of stuff?
That's a tough one. I don't know. You know, showrooms, Best Buy is the most widespread showroom I know of. And within many Best Buys is something called Magnolia Audio
yeah
Video.
That's their high-end audio.
Which is kind of their high-end.
But they don't have room to show a projector, do they?
Well, but again, you don't need
you don't
as
need
much
room
yeah with these as you do with a real projector, a normal front-loading projector.
So the Hisense is a DLP.
Correct.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's not as good as LCOS in my opinion.
Okay.
The Sonys are what are called LCOS, liquid crystal on silicon.
Yeah.
And I believe that is a better quality picture, generally speaking, than DLP.
I'm tempted though with a 100-inch screen.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, those are all 4K. You might look also at ViewSonic, Epson.
Do you need 4K if you're talking a screen that big?
Right? Well, it would be good. It would be better
would be
if you did.
Okay.
Plus, you get HDR.
And I do want that. Yeah.
Which you don't get with 1080p. But the ViewSonic is $3,500. The Epson is $3,000.
See, these are much more affordable.
Yeah, exactly.
Scott Wilkinson, I can't wait till you put a review up of all of these at avsforum.com. Can I ask for that? That's
we
what I
have
see
one of the VZ1000, the Sony,
there
the big
go,
Sony.
Right now. Thank
right
you,
there
Scott. AVSForum.com. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater geek. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. We'll take a little break. Be back with more of the tech guy. By the way, I'll be back live in studio tomorrow. Tomorrow, I am coming home. I'll be a little jet lagged. Should be a wacky show. Meanwhile, enjoy this show, which, even though it was recorded ahead, is brand new and fresh and brought to you by the brand new and fresh 23andMe. I love 23andMe. Did this a few years ago when they first started. It was created by Ann Wojcicki, who is one of the Wojcicki clan. She was married to one of the founders of Google, right? In fact, her sister, Ann Wojcicki, also an executive at Google and now running YouTube, her mother, it was Esther, rented her garage to Larry Page and Sergey Brin when they started Google, and that's how they all met. Ann's done a great job with this 23andMe. She's created an amazing company. I signed up immediately because, I was very intrigued by the idea of getting my genetic analysis done affordably. I mean, this used to cost tens of thousands of dollars to get your genome analyzed. Man, we live in modern times. Now, you don't have to go to a fancy, clinic, get blood drawn and all that stuff. You just spit into a vial, that little vial of saliva, and you send it back in their specially packaged mailer to 23andMe. It's got all your DNA in it. Everything you need to know about yourself. And then they do the analysis. Just takes a few weeks. They print it out. Well, they actually don't mail you a report. They put it online. But 75-plus reports, always adding new stuff, too, as we learn more and more about genetics. Imagine what you could find out. And as time goes by, what more you learn. Things like your ancestry, where your people came from, not just hundreds of years ago, but tens of thousands of years ago. I could see a map. They have this great interactive map where you could see how your family migration. In my case, and everybody's different, but in my case, Central Africa to the Middle East and then around to Europe. And they show when that happened, what parts, Spanish I am, Scotch. I've got a little Neanderthal, 4% Neanderthal. That's an example of something new. They didn't even know that Neanderthal and Homo sapiens had interbred at all until about 2010 when they were able to do for the first time ever some analysis of Neanderthal, I think it was bone fragments, and they figured out the Neanderthal genome. And then lo and behold, as the time went by, they started to realize, oh, we share these genes came from the Neanderthals. So that's a new report of 23andMe. Find out what your Neanderthal is. It's actually more is better, by the way. My wife, she's very proud. She's got more Neanderthal than I do. My wife's done it. My daughter, my sister, my mother. I actually gave it to mom and sis for Christmas this year. My father, everybody. You want everybody in your family to do it because then you share the results. It's fascinating. You can also find out more about your health and wellness, what you're predisposed to. It really is kind of amazing. It's very 21st century. 23, though, is the 23 unique pairs of chromosomes that make you. 23 from mom, 23 from dad, 23andMe. It's the book of you and you and why you are the way you are. Find out more. Go to 23andMe.com. This is actually a great Mother's Day gift. Through May 13th, I gave it to my mom already, but you'll get 20% off every kit and free gift wrap just for Mother's Day. Go to 23andMe.com/twit. That's the number 23andMe.com/twit. I just got a text from my mom saying, I got my results. She took a while to send it back. I don't know why. I got my results. Share yours with me. I want to know. It's so cool. 23andMe.com/twit. A perfect Mother's Day gift. Something a little different, right? 23andMe.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Now, on with the show. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy on the Cinco de Mayo. Let's get back to the phones. Line three is Matt, Rochester, New York. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Well, after years of looking, I finally found our old wedding video and our old wedding, the old camcorder. The only problem is that it uses FireWire.
Oy.
And I'd like to transfer it digitally. I've looked, and there's a lot of different ways on how I can transfer it to the laptop using composite cable. But I was wondering if there's a way I can transfer it digitally to my laptop.
Yeah, what kind of camcorder was it? Let's first of all make sure it's a digital recording.
It's a Sony Mini DV camcorder.
Okay, good. So DV means digital video. So that's good news. You have a little tape in there, right?
Correct. Yep.
Which is too bad because shortly after that, they changed it to memory cards, which would be easy to just pull out and put on the hard drive. But because you have a tape, you need a tape player. That's your camcorder. And the camcorder's digital interface is FireWire, which good luck finding a computer with FireWire these days. So you can go out and buy a box that will take the FireWire and convert it to something that your computer can handle. Probably USB 3 is what you want. I presume you have a computer with USB 3.
I do. Now, I've looked, not extensively, but I don't think this will work. And I was just wondering if this could happen or not. I've found that you can convert FireWire to Thunderbolt and then convert Thunderbolt because I don't have a Mac, and then convert Thunderbolt to USB. Do you know?
Sure.
If the chain would
yeah.
work?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the thing is, because it's digital, you're not degrading it. You're just the deal is that you need to copy the bits, and the problem is that the bits come in a format that is obsolete now. It's kind of sad, isn't it, that it's obsoleted. Let me just see. The best way to do it would be a FireWire to USB 3 converter. It's not going to be a simple pin converter, you know, just a cable. It's not, the question is not merely that the connectors are different. It's actually that the way the bits come in are slightly different. I don't think these are too expensive. Let's see. Well, so there's a couple of choices. Do you have a tower PC you could put a card in?
No, I've seen those, because then you can just buy a FireWire.
Then you buy a FireWire card for $15. Okay.
No, and then my laptop is not old enough to need a PCMI.
You don't have one of those either?
No.
Okay. Wow, it looks like they're... Oh, okay. $13.94 uses DMA. All right, so that, yeah, now I see where the problem is. It's not merely that the bits are different and the connector's different. It is looking for a different kind of software interface. So it might be kind of an expensive device. What you really might want, let me see if the chat room has that. This is an interesting conundrum. I didn't realize it would be so difficult. So you think you've seen stuff that will convert it to Thunderbolt?
Well, no, just the cabling. So I've seen that you can convert FireWire to Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt to USB, but I didn't know if that would work at all just based upon the different type of signal it was.
So here's the problem. FireWire is a peer-to-peer system. It expects... Yep. That's why you can FireWire two camcorders together. USB is a client-server system. It has a master computer, and then it controls something else. So, in effect, what you would need is another computer on the other side of the FireWire port, as opposed to a USB connection. And the computer would have to do some work, some conversion. Let me look here. Boy, this is... You know, the other alternative, frankly, is to go to a service bureau that has a FireWire computer, and they will charge you a fee, but they'll do the conversion for you. And that's what most people do with these old... I have a bunch of mini DV tapes too, and I think that's what I'm going to end up doing.
That was my thought. It was going to cost, and I'd like to be able to do it on my own without having to rely on somebody else.
Yeah.
And then I want to do the editing myself, and I'm hoping they could put it on a digital platform to where I can load it onto my computer and then do my own digital editing.
It already is digital. So really all you need is you need to get the bits off of that tape. And then it'll be in a format that's a little weird. There's all sorts of software you can use to convert it so that you can edit it. So the good news about this is you don't need something that will convert digital to analog. The bad news is the connector is troublesome. We need to get a way to get that FireWire data. I'm doing, as you might imagine, a bunch of Google searches here, trying to find somebody who makes something along these lines.
The other problem I think we might have is that in order to get, it's not just a file. I think you actually have to play the video in order to remove it from the tape, because it's not any hard drive.
That's right. You have to play it back.
Yeah.
But it will play back and spit out bits. So it's not playing back an analog video signal. It's spitting out bits. Yeah. The only on the camcorder, the only outputs are FireWire, and is there anything else?
No, it has a mini USB on it.
Oh, it does.
But I'm not
sure. That's low quality, unfortunately, because it's USB 2. I remember these old Sony camcorders. Those were really more for control than for outputting the data. You can output the data, but you'll degrade it. Because it's not fast enough.
I tried hooking that up and it didn't do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember these. I mean, it almost would be cheaper to buy a computer with a fire, like an old eBay computer with FireWire. I am not seeing many FireWire converters. This is terrible. They kind of left us in the lurch, didn't they?
Yeah, I've looked, and I didn't see anything as far as FireWire converters.
I think you got me on this one. You might be able to buy a FireWire, this might be the other way to do it, is a hard drive with FireWire that's designed to record this video as you play it back.
Okay. There is such a thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes. I'm really challenged by it. I'd never thought about how hard this was going to be. If you don't have an PCM, CIA, or Express card slot, if you have a Thunderbolt port, now one thing, this is probably the better solution. There are computers with Thunderbolt ports. Almost all modern computers have Thunderbolt. And it turns out FireWire to Thunderbolt is easy. Apple even makes a Thunderbolt to FireWire adapter.
Yeah.
But you're saying you don't have a Thunderbolt on your computer. You only have USB 3.
I have, yeah. I think that's all I have.
Find a friend with a modern computer. All the computers sold this year and most sold last year have Thunderbolt cables.
Okay.
Thunderbolt ports. That it turns out, and Apple sells this FireWire to Thunderbolt cable for, you know, under $50.
Yep.
So that's an easy thing to do. Now I understand your question, which is, all right, well, if I convert it to Thunderbolt, can I then convert Thunderbolt to USB? That might be a little more challenging. So Olivier has posted a link in the chat room to an article on TechWalla that says how to convert FireWire to USB. Beware of FireWire to USB adapters. External hard drive with FireWire is a good option. That's what I had referred to. You could purchase a hard drive from NewerTek or LaCie that will just copy it. You just copy it from the camcorder right over to the hard drive. That's probably your best. I'm going to say that's your best bet. If you can't find a friend with a Thunderbolt port, Thunderbolt's the replacement for FireWire. Apparently, there's something going on with USB that just makes it not compatible. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. FireWire was IEEE 1394. It was a standard. It was an Intel standard. But I think because it is a peer-to-peer standard, that's the big incompatibility with USB, which is master-slave. And Thunderbolt is also peer-to-peer. So I think that's why it works well with Thunderbolt. But you can buy a FireWire hard drive that you could just play back the stuff off the FireWire camcorder. It would go right into the hard drive and record it, right? I'm going to put this article from TechWalla in the show notes. So and Matt, you can Google TechWalla, TechWalla, how to convert FireWire connections to USB, and it talks about all the options. IO Gear and Belkin offer hubs. I think the external hard drive is a good way to do this. But use external hard drive? Maybe not. I'm pretty sure there are hard drives. FireWire recorder hard drives. Yeah. MCE Tech, for instance, makes the QuickStream DV. This is what you need. It connects to a camcorder. And it's really expensive. Okay, it's $800. But it'll do it. It's for capturing DV footage to a hard drive. So you play back the DV footage from the camcorder via the FireWire cable into the drive. Let's see if there's another one that'll do that. But that's what you need. These are portable hard drive recording units. They were originally created for camcorders that had FireWire out so you could record to a hard drive instead of the tape. But they'll work just as well from a playback. Crazy. Great question. Thank you. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And we got something special here for Hour 2 of the Tech Guys Show today. And a great friend has joined me. You may or may not know that for years I have used a very special microphone from a company called Heil Sound. I use a PR40. And I first found the PR40 back in 2005, I think. I won one as a prize at one of the first podcast expos, and I fell in love. It was one of those things I couldn't stop playing with my voice, talking. I loved this microphone so much, and that's when I met my bestest buddy, Bob Heil, who I just adore. Bob Heil's a legend in our industry because he was a sound man for some of the best bands in the world, including The Who. And is also, for amateur radio enthusiasts, a legend because his microphones are widely used by hams. And for the first time ever, I am now seeing the Heil Sound Warehouse. Hello, Bob Heil.
Well, hi, Leo, and greetings to everybody. Yes, we've never done a show together from here. We're in Fairview Heights, Illinois. If I go stand on the roof, I can see the great St. Louis Arch. We're about 12 miles away from
it. So cool. It's so nice to see your offices. Bob hosts a regular show every Wednesday night on our Twit network called Ham Nation. How long have you been doing Ham Nation?
I think it was your idea, by the way, and I think we started this in 2010. We just did program 346.
That's so awesome. You and Gordo and the gang are so great, and of course got me into being a ham. I'm a bad ham, though. I have all the equipment. Ray Novak from the fabulous
ICOM
gave me so much. I have the best Radio Shack in the world, but I never go on because – well, I talk too much on the radio as it is. I get home, I want to shut up. But you've been doing something on Ham Nation that is really cool, the Pine Board Project. Tell me about that.
What goes on here, from day one, we've always tried to get people to build, and I kind of invented a little segment called Smoke and Solder, and we did a few, but it's hard to do it all at the same time. So we got a broadcast engineer, George.
George
Thomas is amazing, and he builds all kinds of things. But I wanted to do something a little special, and I started out building a little mic preamp on a piece of pine board. This is the way we did it back in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And when I got into this hobby in 1956, we were doing things like that. This happens to be the front end of a Fender Twin Reverb a guitar amp, the preamp of it. And I thought, wow, let's go. So we started in building little pieces of it. And it became really popular. We've got over 100 people, and we know that from the count of people buying parts. And here's a picture of the pine board. There it is, right there.
Now, who would build this, and what would you do with this? This is for have to have an amateur radio license, right, to do this?
Yeah, you put it on the air. It's AM. And
wait a minute, I can have a little AM transmitter in my house?
Yeah, we're going to turn it on here in just a minute. Let me go through a few things. What we did is we had to first build a power supply. So that was on its own little board. And you'll notice we laced the cables. In today's world, they
so pretty.
Wiretap them down. And back in those days, it was waxed lines, and we would lace those cables. Then I built the preamp, but I put some equalization in the mix. So we've got equalization and a high boost. And then we built the final. Now, this final has been through about three or four rebuilds. This one is pretty crazy. This one is band switching. You'll see that switch on the front. Let me get the camera set up over here.
So this is. I mean, I grew up with Heath kit. This is kind of like a Heath kit.
It is.
Except you get all the parts yourself and put it together.
Yep.
And you'll learn a whole heck of a lot about electronics and about amateur radio. Wait a minute, Bob. I see some vacuum tubes in there. Is that thing using vacuum tubes?
Oh, absolutely.
Where do you get those?
Oh, we get all of the parts from a company in Mesa called Antique Electric Supply. And they have pine board kits now in their catalog. They have the pine board power supply. They have the pine board mic preamp. and they have the Pine Board Final. And that's how we know there's over 100 people building, and we know there's a lot more because they keep running out of parts. Let's do something fun. I'm going to turn it around backwards.
This really looks cool as well.
You'll notice on the back there's a light bulb sticking out the back. Well, in the old days and these days, we use that as a dummy load. So I'm going to turn it on.
Oh, so it's not just for aesthetics. That actually is using up some juice.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. I just put it into transmit. Now I'm going to dip, and I'm going to tune it up, and the old light will come on here in just a minute.
So that coil in the back, that's the tuner we're looking at.
That's the final.
That's the
final. We're going to resonate it here in a minute.
Okay.
And there it comes. There you are.
Wow. And the light comes on, and what does that mean?
Well,
that's instead of an antenna.
Well, that's 5 watts on 160 meters. the crystal in here is on 1985.
Isn't that cool?
And then I can switch the switch, and the next crystal's up. That's 3885. Now we're on 75 meters, but I got to go tune it. And there we are on 75 meters. And yes, you can use meters to do that, but I'm still an old dog, and I know it's only 5 watts, and a 47 light bulb works great.
Now, how far can 5 watts go? Is that a lot or a little? I mean, I'm used to radio transmitters that have 100,000 watts or 50,000 watts.
I have a group down in North Carolina, the club. Has started a whole pine board project. They have pine board nets. And the other day, one of the guys in North Carolina worked one of our MOCAM net up in Columbia, Missouri. And so with good conditions and stuff, you can work hundreds, if not 1,000 miles.
Wow. And because AM also has some skips, right? So that gives you a little bit more distance
well,
on that.
Yeah, that particular frequency, we can do that at night when things are better.
Yeah. I know because I used to listen to the radio late at night.
Yeah.
So you can get all the parts for this at an antique electronics supply, but where can I get the information about how to make this thing?
You go to our website. A wonderful thing happened on the way to the whole project.
Yeah.
You know how valuable the chat room is.
Oh, we have a wonderful chat room here, and they really love Ham Nation.
Yes, we have a whole group of them. And the first, I started with a whiteboard drawing the schematics, and they were terrible. And one of the guys said, I think I can help you. Boy, did he. Look at these drawings that he does.
Oh, they're beautiful.
They're better than Heathkit.
Oh, that's gorgeous. And they're big, too. Makes it easy to read.
And well, the thing about that, Leo, you don't need a schematic. Well, we also have the schematics. But if you have all the parts, just lay them out like this and it'll work.
Yeah.
Here's the power supply.
Look at that.
And it's really wonderful.
Now you have to be a licensed amateur to use this, right?
Yes.
Can you be a technician or do you have to have a general?
No. Well, if you wanted to build it for 6 meters, but we haven't done that yet.
Okay.
But things are working that the FCC is working on giving the technician a little bit more room and bandwidth. So we might have that coming too.
So you need to be a general right now. And what's the website again that I can send people to?
Okay. Here's what you want to do. You go to heilsound.com.
Yep.
H-E-I-L-S-O-U-N-D.
Yep.
Down at the way bottom. This has nothing to do with microphones and stuff. The website does, but you go way down at the bottom, and we've got about 50 or 60 pages and a lot of comments in all of these famous drawings that have become famous now. The whole pine board section is right there.
Oh, look at that. I see it right there. So click the amateur radio button and go to the pine board site. Bob, hang on for a bit. We got to take a break. Bob Heil, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're talking to Bob Heil, legendary sound man, amateur radio enthusiast. In fact, I think Bob Heil's probably created more hams than, and I mean that in a good way, more hams than anybody in the world. His show, Ham Nation, is a must listen to. It's every Wednesday on our Twit network, and you can go to twit.tv/HN to subscribe to that. And we've been talking about, this really cool, kind of old school, Heathkit style project for building a ham radio that operates on the AM band. It's called the Pine Board Project. And we had to take a break, but Bob, you were telling me that you can get all the information on this if you go to Heilsound, Bob's site, HEILSOUND.com. Click the amateur radio side of that, and then scroll down a little bit. You'll see the whole Pine Board Project here. And this would be for you. You could do, I think an adult would need to do this, but it would be a great project to do with a young person who wants to learn more about electronics and so forth, right?
Well, I know a 12-year-old girl. We have some teenagers. One of them is his uncle, who's a ham. A number of clubs are taking this on as a project.
Oh, great project for a club.
Yeah. And then after they build a few of them, they have a net. And one of the cool clubs is up in Fairbanks, Alaska. They've got a pine board Saturday afternoon a workshop, and every once in a while I'll tune in a Skype with them, and they're building pine boards and getting ready to have their own net where they all get on at a specific time all with their pine boards. So we have really created something, so much so that the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League, they picked up on this, and in their DIY issue of January, I wrote the article and they published it. Not only did they publish it, it was on the cover.
Oh, look at that, on QST. Wow, that's awesome.
And then I just got this a few weeks ago. It won the cover award.
No kidding.
And that's awarded by the readers that vote on the different articles. So we're very, very excited about this because it's turning a lot of people onto ham radio in the building prospect.
It tells me there's real interest. I'm really, in a way, gratified to see this, because we now live in kind of this age of disposable technology. Nobody knows how it works. Nobody understands how it works. You can't even replace the battery. You just throw it out when it's done. And this is the exact opposite, where you know how it works. You built it yourself. You learn a lot about it. It's one of the reasons I'm a big supporter of amateur radio in general, is it brings it back to knowing what you're doing, understanding what you're doing.
Exactly. One of the other things we do is George Thomas, he comes on after we do a segment or so and explains, how does a 12AX7 tube work? How does the equalizer work? What's those big things in the power supply? He explains it in very cool, low mentality,
low
as
tech.
I call it.
Not low mentality, low tech.
It's really, really cool.
He dumbs it down, huh?
George is the best. And Gordon West, who has really done a lot for this hobby with all of his books and his to get our license, he really helps us. Then we got Valerie doing all of the contest work and all these great people. Amanda watches the chat room, and that's really something because it's just fired up all the time.
But, of course, in Gordo's books and tapes are how I got my license. I'm a general. And it really made it so much easier. One of these days I'm going for the advanced. I'm going to get the new books, and I'm going to take the next step on that.
One of the things that just happened, I just got this yesterday, the FCC just put in another license count. Amateur radio is now up over 750,000.
Wow.
And it just grows like crazy. And a lot of people say, oh, is it dead? No. And what's driving it, Leo, is the digital things. A lot of guys don't even own a transmitter for audio. They're doing digital work, and it's just amazing what's happened to ham radio.
Yeah.
So a lot of different things going on.
It was funny because I was on a cruise a couple of years ago, and a guy was sitting in the lobby on a boat in the middle of the ocean on his smartphone. He said, yeah, I'm on EchoNet. I'm just doing a little ham. I said, what? Huh? He said, oh, yeah, you can do it from your smartphone now. It was wild.
But we've made this very simple with all the great drawings from Gene, W4IQN, and Chip K9MIT. Chip does what you're looking at on the screen right now. Chip takes all of the little segments of 10, 12 minutes.
They're all videos.
He puts them in a PDF file. So you can go on that Heil Sound site and see all of the things. It's really something.
Now, a little safety note. When you're talking about the power supply, you're talking about high voltage. So please don't, you know, be very careful. I don't want to lose any listeners. When you're doing this, you need to know what you're doing. Read carefully before you launch into this. And if you have a youngster, you absolutely want to make sure that there's adult supervision so that they don't get hurt either.
Well, what you need is one of these. Chip, K9MIT. We call this the chip stick. In the real world of big-time broadcast, they call it the Jesus stick. And what you do, you clip this to the ground.
Yeah.
Then you take this when you turn it off.
Yeah.
Because after you turn it off, there's still voltage flying around.
Yeah.
And you take this and touch the caps.
Zap it off.
And
it, all right.
And you take care of it. Every program, we talk about that. And it's respecting high voltage. It's all you have to do. Respect it, and we have not had any problems with that because we talk about it so much. And Chip has really come out with the chip stick. He walked around Dayton last year handing them out.
It looks like it's a wooden paint stirrer with some wires stapled onto it. I love it. It is from Lowe's. Bob Heil, they're saying in the chat room, you've created more hams than Smithfield, and I think that that's the truth.
I don't know. I'm constantly working. I've just finished a two-year project. You're going to hear a lot about this. It's a parametric receive system, complete with a speaker that I have some of Paul Klipsch's, my great mentor's thoughts in.
Wow.
25-watt amps. This is an amazing thing because there's a lot of us that are older and we have some hearing loss. This will take care of it, but we're able to finally make the receiver sound really good.
That's
so
really cool.
We're just going crazy on Ham Nation these days, and I hope that everybody joins us on those Wednesday nights. Joe Walsh, WB6ACU. Yeah, he does a little music thing too, but he's a ham. And he plays the theme. He wrote a theme for
it. I know, it's a great theme. So HamNation, twit.tv/HN, Wednesday nights, but you can download it at any time. And before we go, Art Bell passed away not so long ago. Art was a great ham. He's a silent key now, but did you ever get a chance to talk to him?
Did. I visited him at his home. He invited me out to Pahrump. He, when the PR-40 came out, he took all of his RE-20s away, and he was using the PR-40, and he was a great guy. He was not crazy, weird. I think that was sometime a thing he did on the
air.
That
was his act.
Whenever I was with him, he was wonderful. Yeah. He really knew what it took to build transmitters and make them work.
Well, W6OBBSK, but he will be missed, and of course he was much loved by his fans and other hams, as are you. Bob Heil, heilsound.com to learn more about the Pine Board Project. Don't forget to listen to the show every Wednesday night. It's on our Twit Podcast Network, and I'm very proud that we've helped you make so many people aware of the very important job that amateur radio does in this country to keep us safe, to keep us informed, and to have a lot of fun and learn about electronics.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bob Heil.
Thank you, Leo.
Really great to talk to you. More of your calls still to come. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, I don't have to tell you how much I owe to Tim and Don and the guys at IT Pro TV. They're great people. Been big supporters. Actually, you know, they owe me too. I'll be honest. Because they came to me. So it all started when Tim Broom tells a story. Tim's actually really interesting. He was working in the transportation industry. He decided he wanted a career change. He got into IT. This is not an unusual story. I know a lot of you maybe can tell the same story, right? Got a little job dissatisfaction, always loved technology, got into IT. Then he got into IT training. He was always a fan, by the way, of tech TV, he tells me, the screensavers, and saw a panel that I did at NAB some years ago talking about what we do at Twit and how you could do an online television station, and a light bulb went off for him. He'd been doing traditional classroom training for a few years. What if, he said, what if we did a TV channel, kind of like Twitter, like the old screensavers, but it was all about IT training, about getting the certs you need to get the job and then keeping the skills up to date, getting new skills so you can get a better and better job. What if we did that? And IT Pro TV was born, and what a great solution it's been. They started advertising with us from day one, and they now have, I wish I could get credit for it, 90,000 members. That's just the individual members. Many big corporate members, too, because IT Pro TV is a great solution for businesses that have IT teams. They want to keep up to date, but they don't want to send off site for training. If you do the team solution, they've got a team portal. You can keep track of, you know, who's taking what, the pro portal, they call it, the how they're doing, what classes they've completed. You can even set a schedule. You can see metrics like logins and viewing time, which courses viewed, which tracks have completed. It really is a great way. And your team will love it. It's not, you know, it's not a burden for them because IT Pro TV is very engaging, fun. It's really smart people talking about stuff everybody's interested in. They've got chat rooms. And you can take classes in every one of the most important certs, the most important skills like CompTIA, Cisco, EC Council, VMware. They've got you covered. 3,300 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training. You can stream it. They have an app for Roku, for Apple TV, for Fire TV, for PCs, iOS, Android. Works on Chromecast. It is incredible. Get rid of the old boring voiceover slide snooze fest. And here you see we've configured 4 clients to connect to the LDAP server. No, it's not like that. It's fun. It's IT Pro TV. Accelerate your career. Get a great job. Keep a job. Get a better job. Just choose a plan, create an account, and enjoy the journey to IT Pro TV. Now, here's the deal. You can go to itpro.tv/techguy. to learn more about the team solution and sign up for a team trial. Or you can get the individual monthly membership, and that will include a 7-day trial free. So, you know, you get a week to see if you like it. It's, again, it's itpro.tv/techguy. And then if you use the offer code TG30 when you do that, TG30, you'll get 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription, forever. I'll give you an example. So if you get the premium subscription, and by the way, that includes unlimited Kaplan IT training practice exams. That's the old Transcender exams. They were acquired by Kaplan, the IT training practice exams. You get virtual labs so you can set up Windows Server, clients, do all of that with that with just an HTML5 browser. And, of course, access to all the courses offline. You can download them. Normally, it's $857 a year. After this offer code, you pay only $600 a year. That's so much less than a technical school or even just the materials. itpro.tv/techguy. This is your future. It's waiting for you. What are you waiting for? itpro.tv/techguy. Use the offer code TG30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. itpro.tv/techguy. Don't forget the offer code TG30. Thank you, IT Pro TV. Congratulations on your success. Now back to the tech guy. It's time to travel to south of the border on the Cinco de Mayo with Johnny Jett. We're both wearing silly hats. Johnny is our traveling guru, helps us travel better with technology. Hola, Mr. Jett.
Arriba. I could not find my sombrero, so I found a cowboy hat that I got in Calgary, the Stampede, but I'll use it for, I'll be a Mexican cowboy.
We're los dos amigos. So hello, it's good to see you. Now, you're still home, but do you have any big travels coming up?
I always have big travels, and we're really starting to ramp them up. Ooh. So
summer's going to be a big travel time for you, huh?
Big time.
Ooh.
So I'm looking forward to it.
Johnny doesn't like to tell us where he's going, so I'm not even going
to
bother.
But I don't think I'll be going to Mexico. If I'm going to go to Mexico, I like to go in the wintertime when it's cold.
Yeah.
Or cooler here.
Yeah. You know where I really like in Mexico is southern Mexico, Oaxaca. We went to Puerto Escondido a few years ago for Christmas, and it was so much fun and so beautiful. And the food's great because it's coming from it's Mexican food influenced by South and Central American. It was fabulous. I really enjoyed that.
I've traveled all around, not all around Mexico, but I've been to at least 5 different destinations.
Well, as the song says, you've been everywhere, Johnny.
It's a great country. Actually, so I have a website for you that's going to help you going to Mexico. This one's by their government. So it's the Mexican immigration form that you can fill out online in advance.
What do you mean, moving to Mexico? Is that what you're talking about?
No. It's, you know, when you get on the plane, they always give you the form, and then
That seems to have changed a little bit. Like, the last time I flew back into the States from out of the country, they said, oh, we don't do the paper anymore. You do it all on the app. And then they had all these machines that you would afterwards go up to and you'd look into, and they do all this. And the next time I flew into the country, they said, no, we don't do that anymore. It broke.
Mexico, you mean?
No, into the U.S. And then I walked by all the machines, and they had tape over them. I guess briefly they were trying some sort of computerized immigration forms.
Well, there's a mobile passport app, which is great. So many people swear by it. I have Global Entry, but even people who have Global Entry, especially where you live in San Francisco, the Global Entry lines are so long because everyone has them. They all use the mobile passport app.
I think this is mobile passport. Yeah.
Yeah, but that works. I mean, it just might have just been
maybe
that
it was
one
just
problem
a bad ever. Day. Okay.
Yeah, because it works well, and they're in dozens of airports now. So what you do for that app is right when you land, you can fill it out. Actually, you can fill it out on the plane, and then when you connect to Wi-Fi, when you land, you have 4 hours to upload it with your information, and you can bypass the line. And
nice.
People love it. So this one is actually for Mexico.
This is going the other direction.
And it's not as handy. It's a website. It will save you a little bit of time, not that much, but I do know that people do use it. So you can fill it out in advance, and then when you get there, it gets you a little bit of a head start when you get into the Mexican immigration.
And what do you call this thing?
So the website is IN as in Nancy, M as in Mexico, .gob as in boy, .mx. It's a long one. I'll send it to you. You can put it in the show notes.
Or tweet it at Johnny Jett, we'll put it in the show notes.
And I'll schedule a tweet to go out. And
it's in Spanish. Is there a way to
No, it's actually there it's in English as well. There's an English part of it. I have that. Actually, it's a long URL. I'm not even going to attempt to recite it.
Before my trip to Mexico and fill out the blue immigration form that says I'm not carrying any money and not carrying any animals.
Yeah, as long as your passport is valid 6 months or more. This is a mistake a lot of people make when they travel internationally. They look at their passport and they're like, oh, my passport will expire in a couple of months. I have plenty of time. We're only going away for a week.
Oh,
a lot of countries, including Mexico, will not let you in.
Yeah.
So always make sure your passport is up to date. Not only up to date, that you have at least 6 months on there. Some countries require 9 months.
Really? Wow.
So before you go on your trip, make sure.
No, I did. I checked. I have learned that lesson.
Okay, good. You'd be surprised how many of my friends and family have not.
I had one bad experience, though. I was taking the whole family to Mexico, and we thought that you didn't need a passport. Actually, you didn't at the time. This was before you needed it. So it must have been before 9/11, right? I can't remember when that rule changed. But you just needed a birth certificate. But we had, for my son, what turned out to not be an actual birth certificate, but an honorary birth certificate.
That's a problem.
Something the hospital gives you, just kind of like it's like a greeting card or something. It's got his footprint on it. I thought it was a legal document. We brought it to the gate. They said, "You're not going to Mexico today."
Yeah.
We ran to the county seat. Fortunately, we were near where he was born. We got his real birth certificate, and we flew out the next day. But the honorary birth certificate did not fly. Literally,
it does not.
No. Get your paperwork together. Make sure you have 6 months extra before expiration.
At least. Find out what country you're going to.
At least.
Because some will even require a year. But most are 6 months to 9 months.
All right.
Okay. So I got an app. We got time for an app?
Sure.
So since it's Cinco de Mayo, this is actually a good app. It's called Radio Mexico Live.
All right.
And what it does, it's on iOS and Android. It has over 42 Mexican radio stations that you can stream live. So you just go into the app and you just click whatever radio station you want, and you feel like you're in Mexico even when you're home sitting on the couch. There we go.
Here we go. Cinco de Mayo, everybody. I don't even know what they're saying, but I'm hope it's so. I hope it's legal in the United States. That's all.
I'm thinking the same thing.
Johnny.
If we have time for a product.
Oh, why not? Let's keep going. Sure. Is there tequila involved?
There is not.
Okay.
And, you know, sadly, this has got nothing to do with just Mexico. It's with wherever you travel, including in America.
Yeah.
But recently there was a sad story out of an Iowa family that was killed in Mexico by gas. And it was suspected it was CO2, CO1.
Oh, that can happen anywhere.
It can happen anywhere.
It's odorless. It's tasteless. You don't know. It's carbon monoxide. It's created in furnaces and water heaters. And if the heat exchanger is cracked and doesn't protect you, the carbon monoxide can leak into the room, and yes, you can pass away. It's terrible.
These guys were renting a house, and that's what happened. But there was something in America where one of the hotels had it, and people died in it.
Yeah.
So there's a portable carbon monoxide detector by Kidde, KIDDE.
Oh, Kidde makes a lot of good stuff.
And it's under $30, and it's portable. You just plug it into the wall.
That's actually a really good idea.
So that's one of my little safety tips for when you're traveling.
I bring also a little portable USB-powered humidifier that you just stick into a water bottle and plug into your computer to humidify. Because some places, I don't know, some places are a little dry, like Vegas.
And the mountains, for sure. That's one of my tips. Every time you go to the mountains, you always ask for a humidifier. Yeah. So what's this one called? I got to write that one down.
I don't remember.
I'm going to make that my travel product.
I will go home. I have it with me, and I will go home, and I will – not with me, but I have it in the
–
and I pack it because it's handy only where – I mean, obviously, didn't bring it to the Caribbean. But if you're going somewhere where it's dry, like Vegas, and that is a good tip. You can often ask at the front desk, do you have a humidifier? But they usually have a limited number. And it's been my experience when you go to Vegas, there's no humidifiers left.
But almost every ski resort, fancy ones at least, they all have them. They even usually have them in the room. You don't even have to ask for them.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, because at altitude, it's very dry. You'll find Johnny, we're not dry today, as you might have gathered. Yes, we are. You'll find Johnny. Why is it? I put a sombrero on and photographers came running into the room.
Oh my God!
They're waiting for me to humiliate myself, and then they take pictures. That's how it works. You'll find Johnny at his website, johnnyjet.com. He's got a bunch of free travel newsletters. Subscribe to those. He's also got a travel finder and articles about all this kind of stuff. Follow him on Twitter, too, at johnnyjet. And if you got a moment, take some time to look at the lists he has compiled on Twitter, including lists of airlines and flight attendants and all sorts of great stuff, so you can really stay on top of travel on Twitter. Johnny Jet. Thank you, Johnny. We'll see you next week.
Leo Laporte. Take care.
The tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. On we go with the show and line one, John in Southern California. Hello, John.
Hello, Leo. Last fall, I bought at Best Buy a 9.7 iPad Pro.
I knew it was an iPad because nothing else comes in 9.7 inches.
Right. And when they had the big reduction, they bundled it with Trend Micro antivirus.
What? Wait a minute. They bundled an iPad with an antivirus?
Yes.
Oh, that's a waste of time. Okay. I didn't even know Trend made an antivirus for iOS. That's crazy.
In one place, it says that it works on iOS and Android. When you look at the details on it, it doesn't mention it, so I don't know.
There is a Trend Micro mobile security for iPhone or iPad. I do not recommend an antivirus on Windows, but you can make an argument that maybe you need it on Windows. You absolutely do not need it or want it on iOS.
Okay. Is the same true for the Norton now that LifeLock is bundling and trying to give you a year free trial?
Yeah, so LifeLock is a sponsor, by the way, and I've been a LifeLock subscriber for years. Now because Symantec bought LifeLock, you get Norton for free.
Uh huh.
I won't be
Should
installing
I put
it, but
my iPad?
No.
Okay. Should I put it on my MacBook Pro?
No. The one place you could credibly argue that you need an antivirus, and it's really only for the most unsophisticated users, would be Windows. Mm-hmm. But Windows comes with an antivirus, Windows 10 does, that's not the best in the world, not as good as Norton, but it's not bad. I have the same argument every time we talk about antiviruses. First of all, mobile devices don't need them because mobile devices are really very different, especially iOS. They're very different from desktop. The way you get in trouble on mobile is with a malicious app, which an antivirus won't protect you against. Actually, Google does a very good job now of scanning your app before you install it and checking it against their database of malicious apps. Apple, of course, won't let an app in the App Store if it's malicious, and if it is, we'll yank it. So you're relying on their good offices to protect you, and I think that's more than enough. I never use antiviruses on mobile. The argument for an antivirus on Windows is, well, some Windows users will do dumb things, and the antivirus might protect you, but the might is a big might. Antiviruses, at best, will only catch maybe two-thirds of the viruses that come across the desk. They don't catch the most virulent ones because those are what we call zero days. They're so fresh and new, the antivirus hasn't even heard of it yet. So antiviruses give you a false sense of security. You think, oh, I'm safe. I can do everything I want. No. They also cause problems. All antiviruses hook into the operating system at a low level. Actually, all desktop antiviruses. Antiviruses are so useless on iOS, they don't do anything. They're not allowed to hook in because iOS and Android are much better protected. So they just kind of sit there, and when you download something, they go, let me see if that's a bad thing. No, it's not. On Windows, at least, they hook in the kernel, and they can try to do – but that's dangerous too because when something has that kind of low-level access, it can be an avenue. And, you know, to be frank, it has been an avenue for viruses, hackers to get into your system. Remember the NSA hacking tools that were exfiltrated to the shadow brokers, much to everybody's dismay, because they formed the backbone of the WannaCry ransomware. Thank you, NSA. The way those got out, an NSA, we believe now, an NSA contractor got them, took them home, not cool, man, not cool. And he had on his computer, he had a copy of an antivirus called Kaspersky that had a web-connected, this is the latest thing all antiviruses do, they have this web interface trying to keep up with the new viruses, right? Had this web-connected. It turned out that the Kaspersky mechanism, if it saw a virus, it would quarantine it and send it to Kaspersky in Russia. Well, guess what? It saw the NSA hacking tools and said, oh, and it sent it to Russia. And that's how they escaped from the NSA. So by putting this antivirus on this guy's computer, they opened a massive hole. Don't use antiviruses. Do the right thing, which is update your computer regularly. If you're using an iPad, you don't need to even worry about that. It happens automatically. You're highly protected on iOS. It's one of the reasons I recommend iOS for non-sophisticated users. If you're using Windows 10, update regularly everything on that computer. Don't install any software you don't absolutely have to have. Make sure you be careful about where you get software. Don't click on links. Don't open attachments. Be very careful about what you allow onto your computer, and you're going to be fine. And one of the things I wouldn't allow onto my computer these days is an antivirus. You already got one. You don't need it.
Can I ask a Windows question?
Sure.
I don't use Windows anymore. The last one I have is Vista. But occasionally I have an application that needs Windows.
Yeah.
And short of going to the library, is there any way to download a bare-bones Windows that I can run in VMware or something on my MacBook Pro?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You kind of have to pay for it. There's no free...
I didn't want to buy one.
There's no free Windows.
Wasn't there a developer's kit site?
No, there's no free Windows. No, but you have the right idea. If you have VMware or there's, you know, Parallels is another one that runs on the Macintosh. If you have a virtualization, that's the best way to run Windows. You just run it inside virtualization, but you do have to buy it. The good news is Windows is a lot cheaper than it used to be. I don't know what the bare bones version of Windows 10 is, but I think that's the only way you can do it. I take it back. You can do it for 30 days free.
Mm-hmm.
So Google Microsoft Windows Media Creation Tool. You can download it, install Windows 10 on a USB key, and run it on a VMware without a license key. After 30 days, it'll say, well, you got to activate this. I'm going to start to slow down. Then you just delete it and start over.
Yeah, and I can do what I need to in 30 days anyway. Yeah. So
yes, there's the solution.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah.
So would you suggest Parallels or Bootcamp?
Bootcamp does is it takes part of your hard drive and makes it a Windows machine. That I wouldn't do. Unless you need a lot of performance, just use Parallels or VMware Fusion. You can even use the free one from Oracle, VirtualBox, and that'll give you enough performance to do most things. If you want to do high-performance stuff, then you could use Bootcamp. Bootcamp really turns your Mac into a Windows machine, and when you boot it up, it says, do you want to be Windows today or Mac? So it gives you full performance because you're running right on the hardware. But it's a lot more complicated. I think for most people, VMware or Parallels is fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Now you got me in trouble with my sponsor.
Uh-oh.
Well, the thing is, I love LifeLock. I use LifeLock. I recommend LifeLock. It's nice for people who want Norton. You get it, but I don't. Personally, I'm not a big Norton user.
LifeLock keeps losing my password and making me do a new one every time I try to get in. So I'm a little bit frustrated with it right now.
Well, yeah, I would call them and see what's going on. That's not supposed to happen. But you understand why they're trying to protect you. They really don't want somebody else to get access to your LifeLock account. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to continue on. More of your calls still to come, hour three of the Tech Guy Show. And while I got a moment of your time, let me thank our good buddy Mike Cozio for doing such a great job running the board, keeping the music flowing. Kim Schaffer, who answers all of our phone calls. Thank you, Kim. We couldn't do the show without you. And of course, as always, I want to thank our listeners because they're great, a great bunch. You'll find answers to all the questions, show notes, and even audio and video from the show at our website, techguylabs.com. And join us in the chat room too, irc.twit.tv. Time for a break for news at the top of the hour. We'll have more Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, right after this. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask. Leo, back to the phones we go. And on line two, it's Calvin in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hello, just Calvin. Me. Calvin, come on over. You're on the air.
Hello, Leo.
Thanks for hanging on, sir.
Thank you. I do graphic design using Adobe Illustrator, and I've got version CS5. And quite a few of my older files just will not open. They have a error code, but I'm not at my computer, so I'm not sure what that code is. Have you heard of this problem?
They won't open in what?
In Illustrator. When I go into Illustrator and, you know, try to open these older files.
So you created them. So you're saying you created them in the earliest, or the CS5 version of Illustrator, and you're trying to open it in the current version of Illustrator?
No.
What are you trying to open it in?
I created some of them in CS2. CS2? And I created a whole lot of them in CS5, and yeah. I'm currently using CS5, and I'm trying to open them, and they won't open.
They're damaged. In other words, you're using the same version you created them with, and you can't open them?
Right.
They must be damaged.
Well, I got on Google and looked it up, and somebody on Google said you had to convert to CS5, which that's the version I'm using.
Yeah, no, that's because...
And there's some other very confusing answers about...
Yeah, that's not a helpful answer. That's for if you that's maybe for the CS2 file.
Right.
But for the CS5, if you create it in CS5 and you cannot open it in CS5, that's a damaged file. That's, you know, I mean, that's... You shouldn't be able to... You're in the same version, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So something happened to them. Are they really old? Is that the problem? They've been hanging around? Or?
Some of them are not necessarily that old. Maybe a year, two years.
What error message do you get?
That's what I don't remember, and I'm not at my computer. I wish I was.
Yeah.
But I know that if a lot of them are files that I've sent proofs out on for customers, and I can go to the proof, which was converted to a PDF, and I can open it and then convert it. Yeah. Back to a
but that's a different
AI file.
That's a different.
If I have that proof. If I don't have the proof,
right?
I just got to recreate.
Yeah,
the file.
Those are it sounds like anytime you create a file with a program and then try to open with the same program and it won't open. Guess what? The file got damaged. Now, what do you do about it is another matter entirely. There's two different issues. If you have a really old file from CS2. And a more modern version, although I would never call CS5 modern. What are we up to now? CS9, 10, 11?
No, I don't even know.
Yeah, they don't even use CS anymore. That's how old that is. Right. That's another thing because, you can't necessarily assume that all the newer programs will read the older file formats. But that's not the problem with here. So the CS2 files, if CS5 won't read it, that may be an issue because CS5 just can't read older file formats. There may be ways to do it. Some people say Adobe Acrobat will read AI files and render them as PDFs, which you then can re-render. But I bet you that the files you can't open, you're going to have the same problem with Acrobat or any other program because I suspect they've gotten corrupted.
Yeah.
You don't have a backup anywhere?
Yeah, I've got backups, but even the backup won't open of those particular files.
Yeah, without...
I've also got an external... Yeah.
But sounds like happened is the file got corrupted and then backed up. And that's kind of a problem. Now, I don't know.
I didn't know if maybe you had heard of a workaround for that or for it.
Well,
because it's just irritating when you have to recreate the file, but it can be done.
I wonder if. Yeah, Adobe Support does have a help file, troubleshoot damaged Illustrator files. And it's fairly long, so what I'm going to suggest is you Google when you get back home, troubleshoot damaged Illustrator files. The error message would be valuable because that would tell us something about what Illustrator's choking on. But, there's a number of ways to try to recover a damaged Illustrator file, including placing the damaged Illustrator file in a new Illustrator file, copying the artwork from the damaged file into a new file, deleting unused swatches, custom colors, color groups, brushes, symbols, or styles. And that's just the basics. And then there's advanced troubleshooting. Unfortunately, because the way these files are stored, they're stored as PostScript. Essentially, an Illustrator file is a program that is rendered by the PostScript engine. As with any program, a slight error in the Illustrator file, in the program, could cause the whole thing to fail. So a lot of the troubleshooting involves finding if there's a part of the illustration that is in error, has bad PostScript in it, finding that, removing that, and then you'll get all of the basics. Now, if it were, it sounds like they're in .ai format. If they're in EPS format, that's easy because you've already got it in an enhanced PostScript format. It's the .ai file that's problematic. But as I said, Adobe has 9-10 different ways you can try to troubleshoot damaged Illustrator files. I'm going to suggest you look there. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's at helpx.adobe.com. But you can also just Google adobe.com troubleshoot damaged Illustrator files. That'll help. Yeah, that's, files get corrupted. It's really amazing this doesn't happen more often, right? if you think about it. Line four, we got Jeff from Long Beach. Hello, Jeff. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You're a fabulous broadcaster, by the way, in addition to your expertise.
No, I'm blushing. Fortunately, it's radio. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
My beloved MacBook Pro recently died, and I can't afford to buy a new one. So I'm shopping for a laptop in the $400 to $800 range. I'd like the screen to be at least 14 to 15 inches. And I don't have any special uses, but I do have one priority, and that is I want to broadcast live on the Internet using a service like BeLive or Zoom, which maybe you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And I want to be confident that as long as I have a good Internet connection, that it doesn't cut out or that my lips aren't moving in sync with the sound because the computer is subpar.
Right.
Is there anything that you can recommend? I don't know if you're up on who has what deals right this minute, but is there anything at all that you can recommend for me?
Yeah, there are two places I would look. It is a shame that Apple doesn't offer anything sub $1,000. You pay a lot for an Apple. The good news is, and I hate to say it, but Windows PCs, there's so much competition in the Windows world that there are many Windows PCs starting well under $1,000. And I think you probably want to go to the highest end of the range you could go, but there are probably some good choices for you. I don't think the streaming is particularly tough for a computer. Mm-hmm. But Dell has XPS. Now, they're not 14 inches. They're 13s. But I'm a fan. And because they're bezel to bezel, they don't have – they hardly have any frame on the screen. They may feel to you as big as a 14-inch. I would look at the Dell XPS 13. You can go a little lower with their Inspiron line. That's a little less expensive. But I think Dell offers good value for money. If you get an i5 processor and at least 8 gigs of RAM, you shouldn't have any trouble streaming any content at all. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I'm a fan of Dell. You may find Lenovo has deals from time to time that will give you a good price. I don't like going too cheap on a laptop. There's a lot of junky laptops out there. So,
do you know much about BeLive or Zoom or any of the services that are available?
Yeah, they're all doing the same kind of thing, which is they're encoding. If they're not encoding in Flash, which I hope they're not anymore, they're encoding in a MPEG-4 H.264 format. And that isn't particularly tough to do. As long as you don't have 18 other things going on in the background, and you have an i5 with 8 gigs of RAM, there shouldn't be any problem streaming full quality.
Okay, the shopping I've done so far, they said there's also another issue, not only the i5, but what generation?
You're not going to be able to buy a new computer with anything less than 7th generation, so I wouldn't worry about that.
They're saying the 8th is significantly better than the 7th.
No, I wouldn't. No.
Okay.
In your price range, none of that stuff's going to make any difference. The real problem Intel's had, frankly, is the 5, 6, 7, 8, now even 9. There's not that much difference.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few percentage points difference. For what you want to do, that kind of streaming, it's really bandwidth is everything.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Have fun. Okay. Take care. Hey, we'll be right back with the Tech Guy podcast in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. The good folks at Quicken Loans have created something just for you, the techno-literate. If you're listening to the podcast, you're already like in the elite, right? 5% of people with technology. And you're probably one of those people who says, why do we have to go back to the 19th century to borrow money to buy a house? Why do we have to put on a tie and go to a bank and fill out in pen, in triplicate, a form and then go home and find pay stubs from 2010 and fax them in? All of this sounds so last century, doesn't it? Well, you don't have to do it anymore. Thanks to Quicken Loans, the number one lender in the country, they created Rocket Mortgage, a quick and easy, entirely online way to get a home loan or to refi. It's made for you. It's made for me. It's made for us. And believe me, next time I buy, I wish I'd done it this last time, but they didn't have it yet. 4 years ago when we bought our house, it took us, I am not exaggerating, 2 months to get the loan. We almost lost the house. We were faxing stuff from vacation. They kept coming back. They wanted more and more. It was crazy. It was with the big bank. Next time, Rocket Mortgage for me for Quicken Loans, I'll tell you. It's very simple. You just go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Actually, you can do that right now and set up the account. That'll even make it faster. If you say you see a house, you're in an open house. Oh, we should buy this. Wish we'd gotten a loan approval before we came here. Oh, I can get it right now. Watch. You take out your phone, you surf, you don't even need the app. You just go on the browser to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And it's a secure connection, of course. And you fill in a few simple things, name, address, phone number, birth date, social, that kind of thing. Quicken Loans has relationships with all the financial institutions. So all you have to do is give permission. They pull the information they need, crunch the numbers based on your income, your assets, your credit. They will find the loans for which you qualify. And then you choose the term, the rate, the down payment. It's completely transparent. You know exactly what you're getting. They say, okay, you want this loan? And all this is less than 10 minutes. This has happened in real time while you're at the open house. You say yes. They say you're approved. You're in. You could show the realtor, we're approved. We'd like to make an offer. By the way, it makes a huge difference when you're buying a house. You know that if you've ever bought one before. But what you didn't know is you can do this all online. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS. ConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. Go there right now. Set it up so you'll be ready when you see that perfect house. or for a refi. Now's a good time to refi. Rates are going up. RocketMortgage.com/TechGuy. We thank them so much for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Now on with the show. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. On we go with the calls. Don in Rochester, New York. Hello, Don.
Hi. This is my first time on the show.
Congratulations. Welcome. You got in at a good time, but how long did you have to wait on hold?
Well, not too bad. I probably about 10 minutes or so.
Oh, my gosh. Can we put Don on hold for another hour and a half? He really hasn't paid his dues. No, that's okay. In this case, I'll let you slide through.
Look. My wife, we were driving home in the car, and she says, you got to call this guy because I've had this question. I publish educational videos on YouTube, and I think it's getting to be a year ago, but they decided annotation wasn't needed anymore, which means I can't put any text in my videos anymore.
What?
And I'm just... Yeah, so they just said, as of May or whatever last year, annotation. Oh, nobody really needs it, so we're just going to eliminate it. And I'm like, I'm sending them messages. Yes, sir, yes, we do. And because anybody does educational videos needs to, throw a little text in there now.
I think YouTube said not that nobody uses them, but it just never really worked very well.
I'll go. It's a bit complicated to use for what simple things you're actually doing. I agree.
Yeah, their problem is really that the annotation editor was created for a desktop world in 2008 when YouTube was first born. And as more and more people move to mobile, I don't know what your viewers' experiences were with mobile, but annotations just kind of Google said people found them annoying on mobile.
Right.
And well, now it's out. What? Tell me about your videos. What do you do?
Well, I taught a parenting course for about 25 years, and I started getting like the children of the people that I had.
Wow!
You know, I'm not going to put my rear end in a seat, for 10 weeks or so to learn this. But they said maybe you can put out videos, and I was like,
what a great idea! Now, what's your background? Were you a pediatrician or an educator or what?
Well, educator, I'm a pastor of a church and basically, started teaching this upon request. And
that's awesome. So this is where YouTube is an amazing resource. For no cost at all, you can make these videos. It's fairly simple to do it with modern computing and cameras.
Absolutely.
Put them up and millions of people can see them. And for years, what's the name of your channel so people listening can see it?
Okay, it's called The 10-Minute Parent.
The 10, T-H-E, number 10?
Number 10, minute parent.
And so here's what modern creators do. Because the annotation thing was easier than what modern people do, but it is really a better way to do it, which is actually burn those into the video. So it means after you make the video... Mm-hmm. You're going to, in the editing, do you edit it at all or you just kind of put them right up there?
Well, I try to make it so they don't need too much editing.
I see you have titles on here.
Yeah, titles and then, sometimes information, that sort of thing as well. And,
so this is kind of just more titles in a more creative way.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Mostly titles and,
So what I think YouTube figures is that nowadays, might as well just let the creators put it in the video itself. It'd be part of the video.
Okay.
So I think that's what you need to do. Now, I've seen people do all sorts of fun things. There's a great YouTuber named Vi Hart. I love her videos. She isn't on her videos. Her videos are her drawing in a notebook, and she speeds them up a little bit. But that's a as low tech as that feels, it's actually the way YouTubers she's hugely popular, the way YouTubers like it, because it's a way of putting text on the screen that is kind of engaging, right? That's the problem with video is so demanding, wants pictures all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other part is that, the thing I've always said is that, like, whenever I do anything live, I always say, I am not a talking head. However, in a YouTube video, you become a talking
head. Here's my head talking.
Yeah. Right,
so
yeah.
There's other ways to do it. You know, if you know ahead of time you want to do stuff, hold up a piece of paper with stuff written on it. That is fine. Those are engaging, fun, natural, human ways to do this. Because what is an annotation? It's really the desire to show somebody in something in text that you're really, it's important and you want them to kind of get, right?
Yeah.
So that's another way to do it. I used to, on my TV show, now TV, of course, has all sorts of fancy things like telestrators and things, but I didn't want to distance myself from the viewer. I wanted, and that's what's happening in YouTube, right? It's a very intimate, right. It's not polished. Yeah. It's just you and me. Yeah. We're just talking here. So what I did, I had my producers get me a little whiteboard. You can get a big whiteboard. You can get a chalkboard. I did a lot of stuff with chalkboards, and I would draw on it. It's kind of like a teacher in a classroom, and that actually works well as well. So I guess the idea is, YouTube's decided that annotations just are annoying to people, particularly on mobile, and since more than half of YouTube viewers watch on mobile, they just decided, this isn't a technology we want to keep going. However, if you look at what other YouTube creators are doing, look at what Vi Hart does. Vihart, and she gets millions of views.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways to do this, and I think the idea is make it more engaging, make it more fun. The titles you're using are very old school TV, titles.
I agree.
They're burned on.
Upgraded it and said, "Hey, let's do some more fun stuff with it rather than eliminate it." But
exactly.
I actually went out and bought one of those movie clappers,
Perfect. You're getting the idea. You're having fun with it.
Yeah.
That makes it more appealing. You know your audience better than anybody.
Yeah.
So you want to give them – now, it may be that you have an audience that isn't really the typical YouTube audience. I suspect that's the case. So the tropes, the way YouTube does stuff, maybe not perfect for your audience. So you got to do something that's appropriate to your audience. But – what I always think about is what's going to help my audience get the message best. You know this. You're a pastor. This is your job, right?
Yep.
You don't go up in the pulpit and just kind of mumble. You go up there and you're thinking about how can I spread the word of the Lord in a way that people get it and it's meaningful in their lives and they can use it. So that's what you're doing. It's not a pulpit anymore. It's a video camera, but that's what you're doing on your videos. Think about your audience and make it as useful and fun as possible. So I would say get rid of the titles and start doing some fun stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think your wife had a good idea. I'm glad you called today.
Well, thank you for my call.
I bet you it's not the first time she had a good idea.
No, she has good ideas all the time, and I'm learning to listen to her more often.
It's not parenting, but it's definitely husbanding 101. So your channel, we're gonna say it again, is the 10-Minute Parent.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it, and it's great. Donald Bolt. People, if you want to see it, we'll put a little plug in it for you. And then I want to see what you do that makes it fun and interesting.
Okay, sounds good. Well,
thanks, Don.
You're welcome.
Really good to talk to you. Have a great day. That's the fun. That's what's so amazing about YouTube. It's you have a television station, and now think of yourself as Uncle Milty and invent television. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Gizwiz coming up, but first back to the phones we go. And on the line right now from Los Angeles, it's Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, no problem. Hey, you're going to love Japan. I go quite often. My wife's Japanese, and the wonderful thing about going there with somebody that lives there, you get to go places tourists don't go.
I bet. We did. We do have some local guides throughout our trip, so hi. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, but back to what I originally called for.
Okay.
I got the Panasonic VT60. 65. It's the 2012 model. It's a year gets older than the one you have.
Yeah, it's a Viera. Those are such good TVs.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful TV. But I wanted to know, your TV and mine's, do they, how do they compare to the newer TVs with the HDR and the old ads?
That's a great question. Yeah.
I'm thinking about buying one, but mine just still looks good. So I don't know.
I would stick with what you got. Now here's the deal. So this is yours is a plasma, as is mine. And that really is the best quality image there is. It's just gorgeous. And I think that Viera is gorgeous. There have been some changes, though, since you got it in 2012. You mentioned one, which is UHD. Yours and mine both are 1080p. That's not going to make a big difference unless you're sitting pretty close to the TV. How far from the TV are you?
About 10 feet away.
Okay, you might notice the difference. The 4K only becomes important if you're pretty close to the screen and you could see the dots. If you can't see the dots at all, you know, having more dots isn't going to make much difference. Now, there is something that will make a difference no matter how close or far from the screen you are, and that's the new HDR. High dynamic range means the darks on the screen, the blacks are blacker, the bright parts of the screen, the whites are whiter, and there's a bigger difference between the two. That's the dynamic range, the distance between the darkest and the lightest. HDR makes a difference. But again, unless you saw them side by side, you might not notice it. Because you have a beautiful image on that Panasonic.
Oh, it is. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
I love it. And,
yeah.
You know, I do have an LCD TV, and I compare the two. I mean, besides the soap opera effect, I still think my TV...
Oh, I agree. Plasma's better than LCD. The newer OLED TVs are... The first thing that's come along that's as good as plasma. Plasma, the only limitation with plasma is there's a little bit of burn-in potential. These Vieiras are pretty good at protecting that. I've had mine as you have. You've had yours for 6 years. I've had for mine for five. No burn at all. And the other issue, and we may start to notice this, early plasma TVs started to fade out, particularly the blue started to fade out. The dye would die on these plasmas. And and then overall, the plasmas, especially at high altitude, start to osmos gas a little bit, and so they start to lose the richness of color. But I think in modern plasmas, that's not the case. I've not noticed it. Have you noticed any of that? The saturation of the color getting worse?
No, I haven't. And speaking about things fading out, I actually have a Panasonic 50-inch. It's a 2007 model. It was the one just before they start installing Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
So it does have the smart apps, but of course you have to plug it in with the Ethernet. And to me, that TV still looks good.
See, there you go. There you go. I mean, the first plasma I saw was 20 years ago, 1998. It was $10,000 for a 50-inch. And man, that thing looked terrible after just a few years. But I think they really solved those problems. And your 2012 probably is going to go for a long, long time. So I wouldn't actually worry about it. I'd say until you say, boy, I'd like to see better. I really wouldn't worry about it. HDR. If you're in the market for buying a new TV, that's different. Then I'd say get a UHD and really do look for HDR. But in order to enjoy that content, now you have to upgrade everything in your chain. That's the most frustrating thing for me was I hadn't really planned on that. But now when I got the 4K, now you have to get a 4K receiver. Okay, got that. Now you have to get a 4K Roku. Okay, got that. Now you have to... get a 4K cable box. Okay. Now everything has to be upgraded to 4K. Actually, the cable box doesn't because cable TV still doesn't send 4K HDR images. But Netflix does, for instance. So whatever you watch Netflix on, you're going to want to make sure it can do 4K and HDR. So it ends up being a lot more than just buying a new television set. I would say wait until you're buying a new TV and then it's probably time to think about it. They're also expensive. A good 4K... You know, if you're going to get better, you know, you want to get equivalent, you're not going to get an LCD. You're spoiled by your plasma. You're probably going to get an OLED. That's what we had to do. And I'll tell you, given the difference between the Panasonic Viera in the living room, that's where we keep ours, and my OLED in my man cave, well, don't tell my wife, but I'm almost always going to choose the man cave. Of course, also sitting a lot closer in the man cave. In other words, I don't think you have to worry. I really don't. I do think HDR is going to make a big difference, much more so than 4K in the long run in television. Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you for the call, Mark. Let's go to Temecula. Mary is on the line. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My question is, whenever I log into Yahoo, my email on Yahoo,
yeah,
I get this weird message, and they're asking me to agree to the terms.
Yeah, they changed the terms. So remember, Yahoo got bought by Verizon, right? And Verizon renamed the company from Yahoo to Oath. And Oath has some new terms. Actually, I'm glad you called because I've been meaning to talk about this. So Oath's new privacy, and you really might want to think about this, allows them to, quote, analyze your content and other information, including, get this, emails, instant messages, posts, photos, attachments, and other communications. It may analyze user content around certain interactions with financial institutions. That means banks. It says its automated systems will, quote, strip out information that that on its own could reasonably identify the recipient. In other words, they're going to take your name out. But it may collect information from your photos and utilize image recognition to identify and tag scenes, color, best crop coordinates, text, actions, objects, or public figures. Now, some of that I understand. Best crop coordinates, color, that's so it can automatically help you modify your pictures. But why would they be looking at the text in my pictures, or the actions, or the objects, or the public figures? It's pretty clear that Verizon, which is not known for its commitment to privacy, in my opinion, has decided to update the Yahoo, and by the way, this is for AOL as well, because they own AOL now too, for the purposes at least of tailoring ads for users. That I don't mind so much. Although I should point out, Google stopped doing that last year. Google used to go through your Gmail looking for information so it could provide you with tailored ads. They literally stopped that last year. Yahoo has effectively announced that they're not only going to do more of it, but they're going to look at more things, and they may even offer that to find, they may even be going through your financial information. So that's why you're seeing that. If you want it to go away, agree to it. But you might want to think about what it means. Now, any service that takes spam out of your email, and Yahoo's one of them, Microsoft Outlook, another one, Gmail too, all of them will have to scan your email. That's the only way they can get rid of spam, is by looking at the contents of your email. But it's really makes me nervous that they're looking at everything you do on Yahoo and AOL and Flickr and Tumblr and sharing that information with Verizon. So now you have to decide, do I want to stay at Yahoo or not? But if you want to get rid of that message, you need to say okay. I'm sorry to say. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And we're dancing our way to the GizWiz show, gizwiz.biz. It's Dick DeBartolo. We call him our GizWiz because not only is he, yes, you know that name. People are going, wait a minute, what? I know Dick DeBartolo. Mad Magazine's maddest writer for more than 400 issues. He continues to this day, despite his advanced age, to write for Mad Magazine. But he's also, I'm proud to say, our Gizmo Wizard or GizWiz because you've been a Gizmo fan for a long time, right?
I celebrated 25 years of World News Now last November. So that's a long time.
So you go on the ABC World News Now show with gadgets and gizmos, and you've been doing that for 25 years?
Since the show started. They celebrated their – yeah, it was. I was doing either wow. Regis or Good Morning America, and someone came up and said, are you a night person? And I said, yes. I said, well, would you like to do gadgets? We tape at midnight. I said, oh, that's like morning for me.
I've done it a couple of times, and it really is late.
It is late.
You get to the ABC building in New York, and it's completely deserted. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
The first time I did it, they said, you want to see Peter Jennings' chair? Because nobody's there at that hour.
No, exactly.
So we went up the, and he has, Peter Jennings, he's of course no longer there, but passed away, but he had a special staircase built between the editorial floor and the TV studio, because it was one floor down, that he could go right from his desk down the stairs to the studio in case of emergency.
Oh, my word.
You know, if he, you know, because they break in with breaking news. So
yes.
He could go right downstairs from the anchor to the anchor desk in a matter of 30 seconds if he had to. That was kind of cool to see that. And I sat at his desk. Actually, wait a minute. Peter was there when I did that. Because you remember this keyboard, the Guy keyboard?
Oh, the Guy keyboard. He liked that, didn't he?
He loved it. It's a keyboard in alphabetical order for people who never learned how to type. It's A, B. Instead of Q, W, E, R, T,
yes.
It's A, B, C, D. So I had it with me. I guess I was going to show it that night. And I showed him, and he was fascinated. He loved it. I forgot
so
about that.
So he was the one who bought it.
He's the guy.
Yeah, they were at CES just once.
I forgot he was there. Wow, he must have been working late.
That's funny.
I'm sorry. I'm using up all your time.
I am years behind you. I have gotten my first cold coffee brewer.
Oh.
Now, are you still doing cold coffee?
No. No.
Oh.
It turns out I like my coffee hot.
Okay.
No,
okay.
You still have it hot. The idea is that instead of brewing it with boiling water, you brew it with ice water, and it extracts flavor, but they say not the bitterness. Right?
Yeah, but I didn't know when you were doing it that it takes 12 hours.
Oh, yeah, well, it's not for – you don't get a cup right now.
No, so like a month or 6 weeks ago at the gourmet preview, I was saying to the guy, and the guy said, oh, it's going to be – he said, let me send you one.
It'll
so
be
he
ready
sent me
tomorrow.
One, and I get my cup out, and I said to Dennis, so I stir this in. I said, you know, get another cup, Dennis, because I know you love cold coffee. This will be cold brew coffee. And then it says, you know, put in some coffee, put in some water, some water, and now just shake the container a little, and now wait 12 to 24 hours. And I said, what? So what's unique about this, Leo, it's called Asobu, A-S-O-B-U.
Okay.
And if you like cold brew coffee and want to take it to work, this is a very clever idea. It brews directly into a thermal carafe.
Ah.
And so the brewing mechanism screws on to the carafe, and then you put in the coffee. They recommend filtered water, but New York City water was good enough for me. So
York City's got the – people think, that Manhattan can't have good water. It has the best water in the world. Consumer Reports picked it as the best water in America at one point.
Exactly. I had a filter, and outside of a little fish from the Hudson, it was perfectly
clear. If you don't
clear.
Mind a little lead, it's yeah, – no, it's very – it comes from the Schuylkill Reservoir, and it's fabulous water.
It's fabulous water. Yeah. So, you know, you put in the car. Well, you've done all this. You had something that was –
oh,
like
man.
Hundreds of dollars, wasn't
it? I had one. It looked like I was making crystal meth. It was a tower.
I remember the feds came in once. we were recording, and you had to convince them.
I found a place that still makes it using that device down here at Red Whale Coffee in Novato. But it's a tower. You put ice water in the top, and it has a little – it really looks like a chemistry set. A little kind of titration valve on it that you turn, and the water drips really slowly onto the coffee grounds, and then it goes through a spiral for no reason into a flask. And it drips – you set it so it drips like once a second, like really slow – And it takes all night. Yeah, it takes you 12 hours, but it slowly drips, drips, drips. But you know what? After all that effort and money, I might add, does it taste better to you? Do you like it better?
You know what? I think it does taste a little less acidy.
It does taste, yes.
Yes, it does. And the thing is, because it's cold brew, doesn't mean when you get up in the morning, you can't just heat it up and make it into hot coffee, which is what I ended up doing.
So Dennis drinks like coffee milk, because that's what I grew up with, is coffee milk in Rhode Island.
Yes.
And so that's great. Cold coffee's fine, right? Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then this guy has this little thermal container, comes with its own lid.
It has to stay cold.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's white enough, you throw ice cubes in it and you take it to work and you'll have cold brew coffee for 12 hours. Or if you want, you can heat the coffee, put it in this thermal device, and you can have hot coffee for 6 or 8 hours. And it's $50.
I like this Asobu. They make all sorts of stuff, like Game of Thrones drinkware. They're very they're a strange company.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I only knew them from their brewers. That's all they were showing.
All sorts of stuff. Yeah. Travel bottles. 6,000.
Yeah, I know that they do a lot of thermal stuff.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thank you, Dickie D. You can find more of Dick at his website, gizwiz.biz. Play the What the Heck Is It contest for a chance to – brand new contest, I think, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, May.
Just started.
Is it May, June?
May, June.
A chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. You get in the drawing if you have the right answer or if you have the clever wrong answer. Gizwiz.biz. You also see all the gadgets he not only talks about on this show. Tick the button with my head on it that says the tech guy, Gizwiz visits the tech guy, but he also lots of gadgets on World News Now and other places, and it's all there. Gizwiz.biz. Same with his podcast, gizwiz.tv, that with Chad's garbage deal of the day or whatever it is. It's always a lot of fun. Thank you, Dickie D.
Okay, buddy. See you later.
Take care.
See you next week.
Oh, I can't believe it. Time has flown. And it is time to say goodbye to all the family. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Guy Show. Thanks to Michael Cozio. He's our musical director. Couldn't do it without him. Thanks also to Kim Schaffer, who answers the phones for us. Most importantly, though, thanks to you for joining me. Remember, all week long, there's the Tech Guy website. And this is free. There's no sign up. You don't have to pay or anything. I don't even want your email address. Just go to techguylabs.com. And what we do is we put up all the questions and answers up there. So if you hear something on the show, every link, all the information is at the website, techguylabs.com. We also put audio and video from the show after the fact up there. So you never have to miss a show. You can always find it at techguylabs.com. And there is one duty, one task, one thing you could do for me if you go to that website. If you hear something on the show and you either disagree or you have something to add, there's no need to shout at the radio. I can't hear you anyway. Just go to the website and leave a comment. You can go right to the website's divided up into shows. Each show divided up in hours. Each hour divided up into calls and segments. So you can go right to that particular segment and add a response. That's one case, by the way, where we do ask you to log in through a Google account or a Twitter account or a Facebook account. And that's just to discourage spammers. That's all. And we don't use that information in any way. Can't promise Facebook doesn't use it, but we don't use it. Thanks for joining me. I hope you have a great Geek Week. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. We'll see you next time. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.